Once he was on the porch, Jason flattened himself against the wall between the window and the door and listened. There was no sound of any kind coming from inside, which made him even more leery of ambush. Sliding closer to the corner of the window, he peered inside. The dingy glass was almost opaque, but he could see the old man sitting in the rocking chair by the fireplace. From his angle, he could not see anyone else in the room. He went to the door and, with the muzzle of his rifle, pushed it slightly ajar, enough to see the end of the room opposite the fireplace. There was no one else in the saloon. He pushed the door wide open, glancing in the crack between the door and the frame to make sure no one was standing behind it. But there was no one. He stepped in.
Well, if it ain't Jason Storm, come back to visit old Briny. What brings you back so soon?
Jason was about to answer, but jerked his rifle back up in quick reaction to Horace entering through the storeroom door.
Whoa!
Horace came to a panicked stop when he saw the rifle leveled at him.
Whoa, don't shoot the hired help! Hey, shut the damn door!
Jason lowered the rifle again.
Damned if you ain't jumpy as hell tonight. You looking for somebody?
Where are they, Briny?
Who?
You know damn well who.
Jason strode to confront Briny.
Mace Cantrell and the dark-haired fella he's riding with.
Why, hell, that pair of outlaws? I haven't seen him.
He done gone.
That a fact?
Now, Jason was reasonably sure that there was only one of them to worry about.
Where'd he go? He didn't take his horse.
They ain't been here.
Briny shot Horace a blistering glance that was caustic enough to silence the simple man. Judging by Horace's reaction, Jason felt sure the outlaw was still there.
Wasn't Cantrell, was it, Horace? It was that other fella that rode in with him, right?
Right.
Shut up, Horace! There ain't nobody here that you're looking for, Storm, so why don't you just go on your way and leave honest folks alone?
Jason nodded toward the door Horace had just come in.
What's in there, Horace?
Storeroom.
Peering cautiously inside, he saw there was no one in the room. He also saw there was another door that led to the outside. He crossed the room and opened it carefully, lest he might find Booker waiting for him to come out. There was nothing beyond the door but an outhouse and a small shed. No sign of Booker or anyone else. He glanced at the corral and noticed that the big gray that Booker rode was still there. He was still here somewhere, but evidently not lying in wait to ambush him.
I told you he ain't here.
Jason noticed the faint trace of a path in the thicket before the cliff.
What's behind there?
Nothing but a cliff.
Yeah, there ain't no caves or nothing.
Certain now where Booker was hiding, Jason stepped outside and walked to the thicket. He pulled a low branch aside and entered it. After walking only a few yards, he found himself before the opening to the cave.
Walking into that hole might be the last thing I do.
Not ready to commit suicide, he turned around and returned to the back door.
I got a job for you, Horace. I saw a lantern just inside the door. Get it and light it.
Horace looked toward Briny for help.
You never mind, Briny. Do what I told you.
He don't have to do nothing, you tell him.
If he doesn't, I might just have to shoot you.
Playing on the simple man's loyalty to his boss, Jason leveled his rifle at Briny's belly. The move had the desired effect.
Don't shoot, I'll get it.
He stepped back inside the storeroom and emerged after a moment with the lantern already lit.
I couldn't let him shoot you.
You damn dummy, he wouldn't have shot me.
Don't be too sure. Bring that lantern, Horace. We're gonna take a look in that cave.
Following dutifully, Horace brought the lantern to the edge of the thicket.
All right, now you go ahead of me now and go in the cave.
Just as he suspected, Horace balked and held the lantern out to him, reluctant to walk into the dark opening, exposing himself in the bright lantern light.
You ain't as dumb as I thought. Now go on up to the mouth and yell out your name. Tell him it's you that's coming in. He won't shoot you.
Inside the cave, sitting with his spine pressed tight against the back wall of the large chamber, Hooker cursed under his breath when he heard the conversation between Horace and Jason. Waiting in the thick darkness for Jason to be silhouetted in the mouth of the cave, Hooker realized that his advantage was gone. The idiot that worked for Briney would light up the whole chamber and there'd be no cover for Storm's rifle. To make matters worse, after sitting in total darkness for so long, he wouldn't be able to see until his eyes adjusted to the sudden brightness. No longer pleased with the odds, he had no choice but to escape. Reaching toward the dull glow of his lantern, he turned up the wick barely enough to light his way and scrambled through the opening at the back of the cave. Horace had told him that this was the opening that led to an escape tunnel. He desperately hoped the idiot had not told him wrong. Hooker stumbled up the tunnel as it got more and more cramped.
Hooker? Me, Horace. I'm coming in. Please don't shoot me.
Damn!
He began running in a crouch to keep from knocking his hat off on the ceiling. With the wick turned down, the lantern afforded barely enough light to keep from tripping on the rough floor. He stopped when he came to a solid rock wall where the trappers had been forced to turn sharply to the right. Concerned that the tunnel was getting even tighter, he decided that this spot might be a good place to stop running and wait for Storm to come up the tunnel after him. Turning his lantern down as low as it would go without killing the flame, he positioned himself flat on the tunnel floor, using the corner as cover. Then he waited, straining to listen for sounds of pursuit, watching for the appearance of a lantern.
There ain't nobody here.
Right behind Horace, Jason quickly scanned the cave room, ready to fire if necessary. He saw the two openings at the rear of the cave.
Where do they go?
I don't know.
The hell you don't! Where's that one go?
He pointed to the one on the left.
Nowhere.
That one?
Jason pointed to the other one.
Little old tunnel goes ways.
All right, Horace. Now you can go now. Just leave the lantern here in the main cave.
Horace immediately obeyed. Jason entered the tunnel without the lantern. He began to feel his way along the wall in the pitch black of the narrow passage. In a short time, his eyes adjusted to the darkness, but not to the point of actually being able to see ahead of him. Slowly, he inched his way along the cold, dark walls.
God damn it! Where's Storm?
Hooker thought he heard some sound of movement, but he wasn't sure. Hell, maybe Storm wasn't even coming after him. He shifted his body around, trying to position his rifle a little more past the corner. Ahead of him in the blackness, Jason had heard the sound of Hooker readjusting positions. He knew he was heading into an ambush. Determined to draw Hooker out, he decided it was going to take a highly risky ploy on his part. Feeling along the wall, he lowered himself to lie flat. Then, pulling his rifle up ahead of him, he fired one shot into the darkness before him, then rolled over to the other side of the tunnel. He saw the muzzle flashes from Booker's answering shots. He aimed his rifle. Booker was caught in the corner of the right-angle turn of the tunnel. Hooker was struck in the arm as he found himself in the midst of a lead hailstorm. He picked up his lantern with the wounded arm. With his rifle in the other hand, he retreated farther up the tunnel, hoping to find a better place to take cover. He ran into a blank wall.
God, Horace, you goddamn son of a bitch! You told me this was the way out of the mountain!
He turned the lantern up enough to see around him, and was immediately relieved to discover an even smaller opening by his right foot. Bigger at one time, the opening had evidently become smaller because of settlement and loose dirt that had been dropped from the ceiling, but it had been braced by two short timbers with a bulkhead across them. Dropping to his knees, he turned around, backed into the mouth of the small tunnel, and readied himself to give the deputy a warm welcome. Being as careful as he could manage not to make a sound, Jason reached the sharp turn in the tunnel without drawing any more fire.
If I ever get out of this damn grave, I ain't never going underground again.
Crawling on all fours now, he continued along the black passageway until something caught his eye that stopped him cold. At first, he thought it was a firefly, then told himself it couldn't be. He realized that it was the glow from Booker's lantern. Once again, he pulled his rifle up and aimed at the tiny point of light. The slugs embedded themselves in the soft dirt and sandstone wall above Booker's head.
Bastard!
Booker returned fire. He realized that neither man had a proper angle to hit his target unless he moved forward out of the tunnel he had backed into, or Storm moved closer up the tunnel toward him. They were at a standoff. Booker immediately saw it as his advantage.
I'm right here, Storm! Why don't you come on up the tunnel a little way and we'll talk it over? You ought to feel right at home crawling around in that tunnel like a rat in a rat hole.
There was no reply. After a few moments, he had a new idea. Taking hold of one of the timbers that supported the bulkhead, he found it to be fairly rotted through. He gave it a jerk and it moved slightly. He looked back behind him to discover a faint light filtering into the tunnel. Horace had not lied. It had to be the opening out of the mountain.
That's moonlight!
He slid back a foot. Then, intent upon closing the door behind him, he tugged at the timber until it gave way and dropped one side of the bulkhead. Encouraged with the result, he grabbed the other one and pulled with all the strength he could muster. Finally, it came loose as the weight of the mountain collapsed the opening, blocking it.
So long, Storm! Sorry I can't hang around any longer!
What the hell?
No! Oh, God, no! No!
Back in the lower part of the tunnel, Jason hugged the floor and covered his head with his arms when the mountain seemed to settle upon itself, dropping small rocks and dirt clogs around him. But it only lasted for a moment. Jason had heard Booker scream when the second of the two cave-ins occurred, but then there was nothing. He had no idea what had caused the collapse of the tunnel, but he felt reasonably certain that the mountain had claimed Booker's life.
Sorry to disappoint you, Booker. There's not going to be a funeral. You're already buried.
Jason lifted the corner of his bandage to examine his wound. It was difficult to argue with Rosanna's lecturing that he had to rest it, and his recent scrambling through the caves back at Briny Bowen's trading post served to aggravate it. Looking at it now, he was irritated to notice the red, swollen appearance.
Well, there'll be time for it to heal after the job's done.
The job being the capture or killing of Mace Cantrell. He was sitting by his campfire on the Jefferson River. He poked up the coals, heating his coffee.
Jason, what are you doing? You got no idea where to find Cantrell.
He had decided to remain close to Briny's place for a day or two to watch for the possible appearance of Cantrell, thinking the two outlaws may have planned to meet there. Now, 3 days after Booker's burial in the tunnel, Jason strongly considered giving up the chase.
It's a hell of a big country. The odds are pretty damn high against ever running him to ground without some notion where to look.
The mental picture of Rosanna waiting for him to return grew ever stronger. It was getting along toward late summer, and there was a lot of work he was neglecting back on Blind Woman Creek. And there was Rosanna. Sometimes he wondered if perhaps he'd misunderstood her, but it would be hard to misinterpret her proposal, words so clear and direct.
I am a damn fool running around lost. A two-day ride away from probably the only woman that would have me.
Then he reminded himself of the merciless murders of Ben Thompson and Gus Hopkins, the massacre of Raymond Pryor and his crew, and whoever might stand in Mace Cantrell's way. Jason had been a lawman for too many years to turn his back on the job. He decided he would follow up on one more hunch. It was a long shot and maybe just wasted time, but he resolved to head east in the morning to see if he could pick up Cantrell's trail. His reasoning was guesswork at best, based on how he figured the outlaw's mind worked. From what he'd learned through Gus Hopkins, he guessed Cantrell got forced out of Helena and Butte, and there were no towns north or south of Three Forks of any circumstance. A crook like Mace Cantrell needed a town. That left east as the likely pass, to the Gallatin Valley and the towns beyond, where he might plan to strike the Yellowstone. Jason let Biscuit set the pace as he followed a well-worn trail along the riverbank. Recalling his journey when he came up from Cheyenne early in the summer, he figured he couldn't be more than a mile or two from Fort Ellis, a small settlement that built up close to the fort where the 2nd Cavalry billeted. If Cantrell did pass this way, it didn't figure he would linger with the army so close at hand. After riding another mile, he came upon a lone log building close to the river. Although no sign proclaimed it, the place obviously served as a trading post. Biscuit could use a little rest, and he was running low on coffee beans, so he guided the horse over to the hitching rail. He paused to look around the room. There were counters at opposite ends of the room, one obviously a bar, the other for dry goods purchases, but there appeared to be no one about. He walked back to the rear counter and idly looked over the shelves of sundry items while he waited for someone to appear, but no one seemed to be minding the store.
Hello? Anybody here?
He started toward a door beside the back counter.
Help me.
Jason turned, trying to determine where the sound came from.
Help me.
It came from behind the bar. He hurried over and found the owner of the trading post, a gray-haired little man, lying on his stomach, a bullet hole in his back.
Help!
Johnny Duncan didn't know how long he'd been lying there pretending to be dead, but it seemed like hours. Jason knelt down to see if there was anything he could do. His first thought was that he was definitely onto Mace Cantrell's trail. This looked like his work.
How bad is it?
I don't know. It's pretty bad, I think. He shot me in the back. Left me for dead. I was afraid to move.
Jason examined the wound to see if he could determine the seriousness of it, but he couldn't be sure. There was a sizable puddle of blood beneath the man's body.
Is there a doctor around here?
No. One at the fort.
Well, how far is that?
2 miles.
If we'll put you up on a horse, do you think you could stay on?
I'll damn sure try.
It was a long, rough ride for Johnny Duncan, but he made it. A sergeant saw him riding in and led him to the doctor. After an examination, the doctor determined that Johnny was a lucky man. A few inches over and the shot would have been fatal, a prognosis Jason could identify with. While the doctor finished cleaning up the wound and dressing it, Johnny felt strong enough to tell Jason as much as he could remember about the man who assaulted him.
Tall, dark-haired feller. Made a camp down below the bluffs and hung around for a couple days. Made out like he was going to buy a whole lot of supplies. And then he shot me in the back.
It was enough to satisfy Jason's suspicions. Realizing now that he was no more than 2 or 3 hours behind the murderer, instead of days, he was anxious to get on his trail.
Go after the bastard. I can get back home all right.
If you're sure.
I'm damn sure. If I felt just a smidgen better, I'd go with you. Thanks for your help, Storm.
Jason got up to leave.
You want me to take a look at that?
He pointed to the bloodstain on Jason's shirt.
That looks like a little fresh blood.
Jason glanced down at his shirt, straining to lift Johnny Duncan up on his horse had evidently pulled at the wound enough to start the bleeding again.
No, it'd be all right.
He didn't have any time to waste. Outside, he found a lieutenant waiting for him on the porch.
I'm Lieutenant Parker. Sergeant Grogan said you brought a man in with a gunshot wound. Mind telling me about it?
Ain't much to tell. Man owns a store back up the river by 2 miles. Got robbed and shot in the back. And if you don't mind, I'm in a hurry to get after the man that shot him.
He untied Biscuit's reins.
Well, not so fast, mister. What are you aiming to do?
Like I said, I'm going after him, and more than likely I'll have to shoot him.
Hold on there!
Jason lowered himself from the horse. The lieutenant took hold of Biscuit's bridle.
Keeping the peace is the Army's job. I think you'd best leave that job to me. We can't have citizens running wild around here, shooting each other, taking the law into their own hands.
I appreciate what you're saying, Lieutenant, but I was a U.S. Deputy Marshal in Wyoming Territory for 25 years, and I've been chasing this murderer for a good while. He's just getting farther away, and we're standing here jawing. So if you just turn loose of that bridle, I'll try to make up some of the slack.
Are you currently on duty as a marshal?
No.
Then you don't have authority to arrest him. In addition, you'd be out of your jurisdiction in Montana anyway. Best let the military take care of the problem.
Jason studied the young officer's face. He decided he was just acting according to what he assumed was his responsibility.
Well, what are you figuring on doing about the man that shot Johnny Duncan in there?
Well, I'm...
Which way did he go?
Well, I don't know yet. I'll have to question the wounded man.
Well, it wouldn't hurt to try to get a description of him, too.
Jason smiled patiently at the lieutenant.
All right. He's all yours. And good luck. Now, if you let go of my bridle, I'll be on my way.
Parker released the bridle and stepped back.
Don't you worry, sir. We will have a detail mounted and in the field within the hour.
Well, I hope Cantrell's considerate enough to wait for you.
Jason left the assembly of log buildings at an easy lope. Once away from the fort, he wasted no time in finding the common trail along the river and continued east. Cantrell was most likely concentrating on putting some distance between himself and Johnny Duncan's trading post, but Jason was convinced that the outlaw was still intent upon following the Yellowstone instead of striking out in some new direction. Mace Cantrell topped a rise at sunset and discovered a small log shack close by the water with a tent attached to the back.
What do we got here?
It appeared to be a store of some sort. Then he looked across to the other side of the river and saw in the half-light a large flat ferry casting off from the bank. He gave it a moment's thought to the possibility of adding to his finances, but decided it was in his best interest to avoid the ferryman altogether. Yeah! He bypassed the shack. A little over a mile farther along, he came upon a small creek that emptied into the river. Figuring it to be as good a place as any, he guided his horse about 50 yards up the narrow creek. His intention was to find a place to camp that was off the trail. His horse was fairly lathered up after a hard run with no rest until it finally threatened to founder. Mace was not overly concerned about pursuit because he left Johnny Duncan dead as far as he knew. No witnesses saw it. He hadn't stopped to count the money he took from Duncan's cash drawer, but he already knew that it was not much of a score. He needed a hell of a lot more than that. But there was the matter of a good supply of ammunition and food staples, not to mention the brand new Stetson Boss of the Plains hat. With a 4.5-inch crown and a 4-inch brim, it was made of a better grade of felt than the old hat he'd left behind, and it sold for $10.
Hell, the hat alone was worth the robbing and the killing.
He thought about Booker, wondering if he'd ever shown up at Briney's and then headed for Colorado, hoping to catch up with him.
So much for that pompous son of a bitch. It's been a good damn day.
The next morning found Cantrell relaxed and in an easy frame of mind. There was a little chance anyone was on his trail by now. He didn't even harbor thoughts about Jason Storm enough to cause him to constantly look over his shoulder. He took his time over a breakfast of coffee and fried bacon, using the new pot and frying pan he took from Johnny Duncan's shelves. His mood triggered thoughts about the war and his time riding with Quantrill and Anderson.
Hell, you just rode into town, blazing away with the reins in your teeth and a pistol in each hand. Shoot anybody that stood in your way and take what you want.
He smiled when he remembered the satisfaction it brought and realized he'd been trying to duplicate the sensation ever since. And to a degree, he'd been successful in recalling those days during the time he led Bob Dawson, Zeke Cheney, Lacey Jenkins, Junior Sykes, and of course, Doc.
Yeah, too bad about Doc. Seemed kind of strange not having him around.
The mental picture of that day in paradise with a big ex-marshal methodically cutting down his gang returned now to ruin his contented mood.
Hell, I had to run. It was a smart thing to do. With that big son of a bitch. I wouldn't be sitting here all by myself if it wasn't for that one damn son of a bitch. I should have hung around that town long enough to kill that bastard.
The time and distance between them served to dim the memory of the cold fear that gripped his intestines at the sight of the formidable lawman.
By God, I'm Mace Cantrell. I've killed more men than you can count on your fingers and toes.
But the one man he hadn't killed stuck in his craw. His peace of mind effectively destroyed. He poured the rest of the coffee on the fire, angrily kicked a boot full of dirt on top of it, and picked up his saddle. Feeling mean and vengeful, he paused while he decided whether to continue east or to ride back west a mile or so to the ferry crossing to see if there was anything there worth taking. It was Jason Storm who found them, two pitiful bodies, a skinny little bald man and his gray-haired wife, laying about a foot apart, the blood from their wounds combined to form one dark red pool between them. Jason stood staring down at the bodies, their eyes frozen wide in shock and terror. Looking around him then in the cramped little store at the few barrels of flour and molasses and a few sundry items like chewing tobacco and baking powder, he wondered what they could possibly have had that was worth taking their lives. The sound of gunshots had led him to the ferry crossing. Curious to find the cause, he had topped the rise west of the shack and stopped to look the place over before riding down to investigate. As he had paused there, he had heard the shots again and realized they had come from across the river. Looking toward the opposite bank, he had seen the origin of the shooting. A party of three men with pack horses was shooting in the air, apparently in an attempt to alert the ferryman that they desired to cross. While Jason had watched from the top of the rise, they evidently gave up on the old man and rode off down the river, looking for another place to cross. Standing now over the bodies, he tried to estimate how long ago they died. It couldn't have been too very long because they were just now attracting flies. There was no doubt in his mind that this was some of Mace Cantrell's work. He unconsciously clenched his fists with the thought that the scene before him now was destined to be repeated again and again until the outlaw was stopped.
Sorry I didn't get here soon enough to help you folks. I hope you understand I can't take time to bury you now.
We found a quilt big enough to cover both bodies. then spread it over the old couple before getting back to the business of tracking their killer. Under gathering storm clouds and still a half day's ride from Big Timber and the Boulder River, Mace Cantrell made his camp by the river in a hollowed-out gully. He'd been unable to lose the sour disposition he'd started out with that morning. The ride back to the ferry was a waste of time. He found nothing of value to pay him for his trouble, and he shot the man and his wife as much for pleasure as for the elimination of witnesses.
Sons of bitches.
He hastily draped his rain slicker over his head. He huddled close against the side of the gully. There was no point in trying to build a fire. He had not chosen his camp wisely, and the gully offered no cover for a fire. There was nothing he could do but wait it out. So he got a bottle of whiskey from his saddlebag. After about a half hour, the rain let up to a random pattern of drops, while the lightning continued its brilliant show of fireworks.
Damn!
Cantrell threw the empty whiskey bottle against a rock at the edge of the water.
I gotta piss.
He walked to the end of the gully where his horse was tied. A sudden flash of lightning ripped through the clouds, illuminating the riverbank above him and the ghostly image of Jason Storm. In less than an instant, it was dark again. But to Cantrell, it was as real as anything could be. At first, he was unable to move. He wondered whether it had been his imagination. Another flash lit up the riverbank again. The apparition was still there, but this time it was aiming a rifle at him. Terrified, Cantrell bolted for his life. The rifle slug passed harmlessly behind him, but there was no time to saddle his horse. Ah! Caught in the panic of the moment, he neither knew nor cared in which direction he ran.
Ah, ah, goddammit!
He pressed the laboring horse for more speed. Left behind on a saddle were his rifle and extra cartridges. His pistol was his only defense against the demon pursuing him. Jason threw one more shot into the dark void, hoping for luck.
Damn it!
Until he'd heard what sounded like a glass bottle smashing against a rock, he wasn't sure if he was close to Cantrell's camp or not. When the first bright lightning flashed, it caught both stalker and prey by surprise, and he had no time to aim properly before it was dark again. Now, the outlaw was off and running, catching Jason on foot and his horse almost 75 yards behind him. Jason thought about the missed opportunity as he ran back to his horse. He didn't know if it was intentional or not, but Cantrell had fled back to the west instead of continuing eastward. At first light, there was no sign of the big lawman behind him, but he held little doubt in his mind that he had not lost him. He had run his weary animal on through the night until he was forced to dismount and walk for a couple of hours. As soon as the horse had shown signs of recovery, he had leapt on its back again. It was not until the sun began to filter through the trees that he gave thought to the fact that the river was on his left and should be on his right. He was backtracking, but in his present state of emergency, he didn't care. By the time the sun topped the trees on the opposite bank behind him, he realized he had almost returned to the ferry crossing. Constantly looking over his shoulder, he finally saw what he dreaded. Behind him, horse and rider gaining on him. He beat his faltering horse savagely.
Rider coming, Lieutenant!
Lieutenant Philip Parker looked in the direction pointed out, to discover a man riding bareback at breakneck speed along the rough riverbank.
There's another in a fur piece back.
Looks like he's either chasing the first one or they're both running like hell from somebody else.
Head him off, Sergeant.
Yes, sir.
The sergeant stepped up in the saddle.
Peasley, Shannon, let's go.
So intent was the fleeing outlaw on the man chasing him that he didn't see the three soldiers riding up from the ferry landing until he was almost upon them. Alarmed at first, he quickly saw him as an opportunity to save his life.
Whoa!
He pulled the grateful horse to a stop.
Oh, I'm glad to see you, boys. That man chasing me is trying to kill me.
Follow us, sir. You'll be safe, I guarantee you.
He followed them willingly back to the shack. He remained on the horse's bare back while the soldiers dismounted and the sergeant reported to the lieutenant.
Sir, the gentleman says he's being pursued by the rider approaching now. Says he wants to kill him.
Parker turned to look at the second rider, who had now slowed to a lope. He was close enough for him to recognize both the horse and the rider.
That's the man who brought Johnny Duncan to the doctor.
He turned and took a good look at Cantrell and decided that this must be the man Jason intended to apprehend.
What's your name, mister?
Johnson. And I thank you boys for saving me from that son of a bitch.
Parker stared into Cantrell's eyes in an effort to determine the truth of his answer.
Sergeant, put a guard on him till we get the true story on this.
Wait a minute. You arresting me? He's the man you need to be arrested.
Mace pointed at Jason, closing in on the patrol.
You can't hold me anyway. I'm a civilian. You ain't got no jurisdiction over me. I ain't done nothing anyway.
I've got jurisdiction, but I didn't say you were under arrest. We're just going to detain you for a while till we find out what's going on.
Parker turned away then to await Jason.
Well, Mr. Storm, I believe. I see you didn't take my advice to let the Army handle this.
Lieutenant?
Jason dismounted and took a long look at the sullen face of Mace Cantrell.
Looks like you got the man that shot Johnny Duncan after all. It's lucky for him that you got him first. You could add the murders of those two poor souls inside the shack yonder, I expect.
I ain't never been in that shack!
Sergeant, shut him up!
Cantrell dutifully kept his mouth shut when the sergeant threatened to ram the butt of his carbine against his jaw. Parker turned back to Jason.
I've no doubt I've got the man that shot Johnny Duncan, so I'm going to advise you again that you're through with it. It's the Army's problem now.
What are you going to do with him?
We'll take him back to the guardhouse and give him a fair trial. But it doesn't look like there'll be any question about his guilt.
The lieutenant paused to send a bored glance in Cantrell's direction.
Then I expect we'll hang him. We'll bury Wilburn and Gladys Yates, then start back to the post. Sergeant Baker, relieve Mr. Cantrell.
He glanced at Jason.
Cantrell, right?
Jason nodded.
Relieve Mr. Cantrell there of his weapon and tie his hands behind his back.
The sergeant looked at Cantrell.
Get down off that horse.
You ain't got no evidence against me, damn you! I'm not going anywhere!
Private Shannon.
Sir.
Assist me, please.
Oh, you damn blue bellies!
Mace tried to draw his horse back, but the soldier grabbed his bridle and held the horse firm. In a desperate attempt to escape, Cantrell drew his pistol. He shot the young soldier. Then kicked his already exhausted horse into a gallop, bolting through the detail before anyone had a chance to stop him.
After it! After him!
In the chaos that developed, men scrambled to get mounted, while some went to the aid of their wounded comrades.
Yeah!
Jason mounted and gave Biscuit a quick nudge of his heels, and the big buckskin immediately leaped to pursue. It was not much of a race to overtake the outlaw's weary horse. By the time Cantrell reached the top of the rise, Jason was already bearing down on him, with the soldiers far behind. In desperation, Cantrell fired his pistol at his pursuers. The shots were wild and nowhere close to the target. Ignoring the shots, Jason pressed onward, knowing this to be the final showdown, regardless of who survived. Panic-stricken, Cantrell quit shooting and whipped his horse mercilessly for speed that the exhausted animal could no longer provide. Jason closed the distance between them. finished, the sorrel slowed to a walk, its steps faltering, then stopped, despite Cantrell's assault upon its withers and flanks. In one last desperate move to save himself from the relentless hunter, he jumped off the foundered horse and put his hands in the air as Jason pulled up before him.
Well, I'm done! I surrender! I'll go with the soldiers!
Jason remained in the saddle, studying the cold-blooded killer of so many innocent people, his hands in the air, but still holding the pistol.
Drop that .44 to the ground.
Jason held his Winchester cradled casually across his forearm. Cantrell cast a quick glance at his gun.
It's empty.
Is that so? Well, I ain't sure I counted all those shots you fired at me, so maybe it's empty, and maybe it ain't.
A nervous smile broke out on Cantrell's face, and he stood motionless for a few moments before suddenly bringing his hand up. Jason sent a .44 slug into Cantrell's belly before the outlaw could aim his pistol. Doubling over with the pain in his gut, he made one last attempt to kill his personal demon.
Oh, you bastard.
He pulled the trigger. He had miscounted the bullets left in his pistol, forgetting the one that wounded the soldier. A horrific look of surprise froze on his face. Forever. Jason Storm had calmly split Mace Cantrell's forehead with an unhurried shot, making sure the ruthless murderer would never kill again.
Damn!
So much for a trial by jury.
Reckon so. He didn't give me no choice.
Jason ejected the empty shell and replaced his rifle in the saddle scabbard.
Is your man hurt bad?
No. Shoulder wound. I think he'll be all right.
Hell, he just got himself an excuse to sit on his ass for a spell.
Are you going to hang around here for a while, Mr. Storm?
Nope.
Good. I'm not sure the Army would know what to do with you.
The lieutenant felt at a loss as to what, if anything, he should do about Jason's taking the matters into his own hands, acting as judge, jury, and executioner. But he was of the opinion that Cantrell got what he rightfully deserved, and he had no desire to detain the ex-lawman. It was a long ride back to Paradise Valley, and in spite of what was waiting for him there, he took his time in returning. Biscuit had been worked pretty hard for the last few days, so Jason took it easy on the buckskin. But in addition to that, there was a lot of thinking Jason wanted to do. He tried to recall all the things Rosanna said that night at the Hatfields, but he found it difficult to do. He attributed that to the fact that she rendered him addle-brained by the suddenness of her proposal. But maybe he misunderstood the purpose of her proposition, and she entertained no thoughts of a real marriage, just a partnership because she needed to have somebody to take care of her.
It must be more than that. She didn't kiss me like a business partner.
He wondered what Mary Ellen would think about his union with Rosanna. He had a feeling that his late wife would have genuinely liked Rosanna as a friend. She might have felt differently about Rosanna as her successor, however.
Oh, to hell with it. We'll see how things stand when I get there.
The little town of Paradise looked to be deserted. Jason crossed the river at the south end and walked Biscuit up the middle of the narrow street. The saloon was closed and dark. So was Hatfield's store, even though it was still early evening. Raymond Pryor's dream looked pretty sad. Eager to see Rosanna, he didn't take the time to seek out Joe Galt or Tom Austin. Instead, he guided Biscuit between the buildings, forded the branch of the creek behind the stores, and went directly to Fred Hatfield's house. Fred was seated on the porch, smoking his pipe, when Jason rode up in his front yard.
Jason Storm!
Fred got up from his chair and opened the front door.
Lena! It's Jason Storm!
Howdy, Fred.
Howdy, Jason.
Fred's expression looked a little strange, it appeared to Jason, as if he wasn't particularly glad to see him.
Did you get him?
I got him.
Thank God for that. I'm glad to see you back in one piece.
Hello, Jason.
Lena tried to smile, but to Jason it seemed more like a frown.
We're glad to see you safe and sound.
Jason looked behind Lena, expecting to see Rosanna follow her out to greet him.
She's not here. She's gone.
Where?
She didn't say very much about what you two had talked about before you left, but she seemed happy enough. And then the other day, she packed up her things and said she'd decided it was time for her to go home.
That's a fact, Jason. We didn't have no clue she was leaving. She just up and decided she was going. Lena tried to talk her into staying until you got back, but she said she'd imposed on us long enough.
The news was disappointing as well as disturbing to Jason. His first reaction was the impulse to scold them for letting her go back alone, but he tempered his remarks slightly.
That's a pretty isolated place out there. I wish she hadn't gone there alone.
We couldn't really tell her she had to wait for you.
I guess not. She is pretty strong-willed.
He thought about the homestead on the other side of the valley.
I wish I'd known. I passed within 2 miles of that place on my way here.
Her wagon and horses are still down at the stables. She said she just wanted to take that one pack horse.
Well, it's a good little ride out to that farm. I'd best be getting along.
It was close to midnight when Jason finally turned the buckskin onto the lane leading up to the late John Swain's house. There was no light in the window, but that was not surprising since it was way past the time when she would have been in bed.
Rosanna!
Dismounting, his heart beating rapidly in anticipation of seeing her again, he went to the door and knocked.
Rosanna!
There was no answer. He walked around to the side of the house and looked toward the barn. There was no horse in the corral. Determined to make sure, he tried the back door and found it unlocked. He went inside. He searched every room of the dark interior, but he found nothing that could tell him if she had come home or not. Fearing the worst, he went back outside and looked around. The cow stood in the garden, where she had obviously been since Jason let her out when he took Rosanna to town. He began to wonder if Rosanna ever made it back to the farm.
No.
The thought made him sick with worry, and his mind flooded with other thoughts of many different things that could have happened to her in these lonely valleys.
I gotta find her.
There was nothing he could do but search every mile between here and town, and hope to hell to find some clue that might lead him to her. Feeling helpless and lost, he knew he could do little until it was light enough to see. He needed food and ammunition from his cabin, but he decided to stay the night there and scout the trail back to town in the morning instead of heading straight for Blind Woman Creek. Jason Storm was awake long before the sun made an appearance, having spent a fitful night thinking about what could have happened to Rosanna. As soon as it was light enough to see, he began a careful search along the track leading to the road into Paradise. There were hoof prints, most of them old, but along with those he had left the night before, he saw recent tracks leading toward the house. Concentrating on him, he followed him all the way back to the corral. Rosanna had made it home, but he found no recent tracks leading back toward town. If she was there, what happened to her? He spent the rest of the day covering the forest around the little creek behind the house, looking for clues and hoping to find none that would tell him what he feared the most. As the sun settled upon the western mountains, he lamented his failure to find a clue. There was only one choice, that was to prepare for a long search. Still being practical, he knew he had to go back to his cabin to get ready for it. He didn't want to lose any more time, so he started out right away, intending to ride through the night. It was well past sunup when he crossed the ridge that guarded the creek and descended to the floor of the canyon. He was still thinking about where he should start his search for Rosanna when he came to an abrupt stop. His cabin stood in sight now, and the thing that caused him to haul back on the reins and pull his rifle from the scabbard was the sight of smoke coming from the chimney.
Squatters. I've been gone too long.
He dismounted. The door hung open, so he approached with extreme caution, with the idea that a rifle might be sighting on him through the open doorway. Suddenly, a lone figure ran out onto the porch. Stunned, Jason Storm could only gaze astonished at the picture before his eyes.
Hello, Jason.
She was lovelier than he remembered. All his concerns washed away under the brilliant morning sun. Running to the porch, he embraced the woman waiting for him.
Welcome home.
Storm in Paradise Valley is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2010, Charles G. West. Published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication prohibited. Performed by Mort Shelby, Michael Glenn, Danny Gavigan, Christopher Sheeran, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Keegan, Tim Getman, David Harris, Michael John Casey, Eric Mesner, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Drew Copas, Evan Casey, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Bradley Smith, Christopher Graybill, Nick DePinto, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, Richard Cutting, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Lynette Savard, Ken Jackson, and Colleen Delaney. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Damien Choppy Chop Richardson. Graphic audio sound design by Patrick Stratton and Damien Choppy Chop Richardson. Additional music by Johann Detweiler. Storm in Paradise Valley theme song by Thomas Hogan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed Storm in Paradise Valley, be sure to listen to Charles G. West Duel at Lohawk, Tanner's Law, Luke's Gold, and Shootout in Whiskey Hill, as well as Great American Western, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220, or www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it. You just cannot stay out of trouble for any time at all, can you, boy?
Preacher, you sure have good timing.
I always have.
Might have showed up a few minutes earlier, though, since you only left one of the varmints for me to kill.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, Number 3, The Violent Land.
Preacher, it is so good to see you again.
Well, it is mighty good to be here.
I'm glad the two of you were able to make it here today. I have a big supper planned.
While you two were flapping your gums, that varmint was about to shoot Preacher in the back.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Matt. I figured you'd take care of him.
What if I hadn't been paying attention?
Well, I knew you would be. Smoke and meat taught you well enough.
Where'd you say you were from?
Germany. Prussia, to be precise.
What's this about a wagon train?
Baron Friedrich von Hoffmann is our leader. He's taking a large group of settlers to the American states called Wyoming. The Baron has bought a ranch there and intends to establish a town as well.
Sounds like a fellow with big plans.
Oh, hell! We gotta do something, Smoke. The Baron's had guards posted, but they won't be expecting something like that.
That's why you've got to get around them and warn everybody at the Raptor 9. Your horse is just as fast as mine or Preacher's, and you can organize a defense. There's no time to waste.
What about the two of you?
We're going to follow them. When they attack the ranch, we'll hit them where they least expect it. From behind.
Damn right we will. We'll have those varmints in a trap right where we want them.
It can't be.
I'm about to ride up there and see for myself. Want me to have the boys saddle a horse for you so you can come along with me?
Damned right I do. I want to see this with my own eyes.
It'll mean going onto that foreigner's range.
I don't give a damn about that. Pick out a dozen men to ride with us and tell them to be ready to fight.
Come on, Bat! We'll cover you!
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Who the hell are you?
I'm the law. And if you pull that pistol, I'm gonna shove it up your ass and pull the trigger.
Graphic Audio presents Shootout at Broken Bow.
Put that thing back in your boot. It's time for you to call it a night. Get your money off the table and clear out of here. Maybe you'll have better luck tomorrow. Kind of an unfriendly way to greet customers.
Well, I'm sorry, mister, but the past few days around here has got a lot of folks kind of edgy when a stranger walks in.
You stay away from my wife!
I don't think so.
Oh, no! Oh!
Shut up!
He was here. Him and three of his boys.
How long ago?
He left here 2 nights ago.
Did he say where he was headed?
Nope, and I didn't ask him.
Did you see which way he headed when he left here?
Yeah, I watched him leave. He started out to the north following Boggy Creek.
So you found us. What are you aiming to do about it, seeing as how it's your gun against our four?
Well, that's just it, damn it. If you'd gone the hell back to Texas after you robbed that train at Durant Station, it wouldn't have caused me no problem. But now I ain't by myself. I expect in about 10 or 15 minutes there's gonna be somebody on that hill above us that ain't looking for no payoff.
My God, somebody's gonna pay for this. If I have to ride into Fort Smith and shoot that judge right down in his damn courtroom! It pleasures me to know that you're looking out for us.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Around you there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free.
Mama, why are my ears so small and so round? Why aren't they like yours? Why are they like Daddy's?
Because, my dear, you are very special.
Special, Mama?
Your father is special. That is why you are, too.
But why?
He's from another world, dear. A world just a little bit different from ours. There are many such worlds, many such existences, universes. They lie side by side, touching as the skins touch on an onlyck. Each skin subtly different, yet subtly the same. We can't see the worlds that interpenetrate ours, but they are there, and they are real to the people or beings living there.
You ever hear me tell about the old days? I remember it as though it were this afternoon. I killed round ears with my sword. Did you know that?
I think I guessed it.
Hard to kill, they were. Great fighters. But the worst of it was they had magic. Weapons such as no sane mind ever imagined. Not swords and crossbows, no. Magical.
Tell me.
Explosive thunders that blew apart men and horses. Lightning that struck with a red bolt and went right through men and war horses and good solid armor. It was as if we were weeds and grass before a fiery scythe. Do you understand what it is to face such things?
You say I'm one of them.
You may be one of them, son, but you haven't their magic. But you will have, won't you?
I don't know.
Don't kill him! Don't!
I never saw anything like that move. You just grabbed my blade right out of my hand. You must be.
You better believe it.
Oh, that hardly seems fair. Magic?
You prate of fair? You who attack nearly unarmed and unskilled boys? You who prey on the weak without a sign of conscience?
Well, kill me then! Kill me and get it over with!
Kill him, youngster!
Yes, strike!
Get him, Kel!
I give him his life.
What? Huckleberry, may I ask why?
Because he's only a man. Only one highwayman.
What are you, daft?
But there are others, many others. As your son has told me.
What are you blethering about?
He can spread the word, he and his wife, about us. What we did today. We won't allow boys to be pressed any longer, or girls. We won't allow anyone to rob or to steal and to kill as he has done.
We'll do it! We'll do it!
Gods, but I believe you'll make a leader yet. Me, I'd never have thought of that.
I see the dragon!
What?
The dragon! I think it's dead! Oh, it's dead, Kel! It's got licked in a fight! Oh, those scales! Oh, we're rich, Kel! Come on up and... Uh-oh!
John! Come away from there!
Kel! Kel, he's going to get me! Kel, he's going to get me! He's climbing up! Kel, he's climbing!
Kelvin of Rudd, Book 1, Dragon's Gold.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.